I can see him in my mind's eye. I can see him as he was then. Sick quite a lot of the time. He was a sickly boy. We went to grade school together at Hillside School in Berkeley. I wasn't aware of any mental problems, but I was aware that he was quite a strange boy, and I liked that.
He lived with his mother. Dicks were divorced. Father lived in San Mateo, and Mrs. Dick, I don't think I ever saw her fully clothed and vertical. She was always resting in bed early in the evening.
I only remember seeing his mother in the kitchen once, and she was making a melted cheese sandwich. And to think of it, I never saw him eat anything. And that's strange, because, you know, kids that age are eating all the time and drinking all the time. And then I saw her feed the cat sometimes, but never got into a good conversation with her.
In the early 1930s, young Philip and his mother, Dorothy, settled in Berkeley, California. It is said that his mother encouraged Philip's early interest for literature. But it is also undeniable that the intellectual environment of the city of Berkeley had an impact in the child's development.
I know that Philip was writing in high school and that he wrote short stories. And early on, he had a little story published in the local newspaper, which had a column for kids' stories. I have never seen that story. I would love to see it. I don't know anything about it except it was a science fiction-y story.
Started having a lot of anxiety attacks going to high school. Sweats, palpitations, shortness of breath. They considered it anxiety. Now we probably would think more panic disorder, panic attacks, and those are different. Started to write science fiction to disassociate. That was his word, to escape.
The question of when Phil and I discovered fantasy, I think we first discovered it in comic books.
Hiya, boys.
How you doing, Doc?
Uncle Underground with the funnies. And I got two of your favorite actors with us today. I got Davey Osmond from the Fess Parker
set. Oh, you're sure lucky.
Over at Universal.
He's
going to read the funnies to you. Hiya, Davey. And Peter Brinkman.
Oh.
Peter Brinkman's from the Corrective Studies Language Institute.
That's right.
And they're here today, kids, to help us, help me stay in this accent, and read the funnies to you. Well, today's funny. Let's open up the big Sunday paper here. Ah, it's Sunday. Gee, it's great to be alive.
I'll hold this side, Uncle.
Yeah.
I'll hold
this one
over here.
You can pick up some of these Uncle Underground stickers for 50 cents at any free press bookstore. Now let's turn right to the first one here. Let's
keep turning.
Here we go. These are, well, now this one, kids, is called Dwarf Revolt Tales, right? And it shows here a picture in the first one of a dwarf.
Those dwarves, as we used
well,
to say
and
down
the
on the old universal
and the dwarf line. Says...
I'm gonna warm up the Empress. Go lay down.
And then the, here, I'll... The comely Empress and her favorite dwarf amused themselves in the coldest room of the castle.
Cold ain't the word for it in here.
I love it like my own.
Keep twisting.
Let's go over here now past the Dick Tracy, and here's one by Moscoso. And here, well, I guess we can't. Here's a good one by R. Haight.
Uh-huh.
And this one, we could look here at hydrogen bomb and biochemical warfare funnies, and
I've got one over here. This is Ruby the.
This has been the Uncle Underground show for another Sunday, kids, and we'll be back.
Hey, I found
Sunday.
One I can read,
oh,
partners.
Great.
The Adventures of Fuzzy the Bunny. Just like old times. Here are these two bunnies, and they. Oh, we were just about to go into that land.
Wonder Warthog and the invasion of the pigs from Uranus. That's
Peter,
pretty
Peter,
good.
Put away your funny books now.
Soul Brothers, hold your fire. It's a pig of some sort. Hey, Peter, bub, we almost busted you. Peter, you look like one of them humans.
He does. Why don't you get him a microphone and put him in another room behind a piece of glass?
Working in a retail store, the people that I knew were television salesmen and television repairmen. And they were completely not intellectuals, and they didn't read. And they would always say, you should go to more ball games and read less, fewer books. Mm-hmm. And I'd go to, I love to go to the baseball games. And if I was considered peculiar by my peers by and large considered me peculiar for reading at all. I just spanned all kinds of different groups there. I mean, in politics, I knew people of different political persuasions. I knew a lot of homosexuals. There was a whole homosexual community in the Bay Area even then, in the 40s. And the store I worked at, they would always, you know, the boss would call me and interrogate me, did I know any homosexuals? And I'd always say, no, I didn't know any homosexuals. My friends were not gay. I mean, it never occurred to me to tell the truth. I don't see any reason why I should have told the truth. I mean, I didn't see any reason then. I don't see any reason now. I didn't think it was my boss's business.
Well, you know, I'd feel rather at a loss not being able to say goodbye with my dear partner. Then there he is. Speak of the devil. Come on in.
I hope I'm back in time.
Perfect. Your timing is perfect.
Get my some champagne.
Here, have some wine.
I couldn't see the street. I parked the van on the sidewalk.
Must have been terrifying.
We'd be saying goodbye, Hal.
Yes, goodbye.
We'd be saying goodbye to the old millennium, for instance, the old silly old century, you know?
Then I think it must be time to say goodbye to closets.
Oh, yes, everybody's out of them.
But I knew some very, very fine poets there in the Bay Area, poets that are really some of America's finest poets, and I was very proud of them as my friends. And they wanted me to be gay, and I didn't want to be gay, so they thought I was strange because I was not gay. And the people in my store thought I was strange because I knew gay people and because I read books. So being involved in science fiction didn't really make all that much difference. It was a small matter of divergence compared to some of my other divergences.
Mr. Speaker, the number one job of any government is to keep its citizens safe. And on this, we have failed. LGBTQ2 communities and individuals time and time again. It is with shame and sorrow and deep regret for the things we have done that I stand here today and say we were wrong, we apologize, I am sorry. We are sorry. For the oppression of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and two-spirit communities, we apologize. On behalf of the government, Parliament, and the people of Canada, we were wrong. We are sorry. We will never let this happen again. Merci, Monsieur le Président.
To the world of biotechnology now, and in a major breakthrough, gay scientists claim to have isolated the Christian gene. Chris Taylor reports.
These homosexual geneticists have spent years attempting to isolate the gene that renders people Christian. As members of the Pink Tiger Research Institute, they're hoping to isolate the cause of Christianity altogether within the next decade.
We have already prevented this rat from being born Christian, and hopefully humans will follow.
Many Christians object to the findings, claiming their belief is not genetically determined.
Christianity is a lifestyle choice. It is perfectly natural
But Pink Tiger claims the controversial religion is part of people's DNA. They say Christianity can be inherited, just like baldness. Until a method is found to remove the Christian gene, gay scientists are counselling local Christians to make positive changes to their lifestyle and values. Parents of some Christians have welcomed the news with relief.
Well, we always worried that if we'd done something different, our child wouldn't have ended up a Christian, but now we know we didn't have any choice.
Now, thanks to the work of Pink Tiger, there is a choice, which is good for Christians everywhere.
This really bore fruit when I went to the University of California and they had mandatory ROTC. You know.
Oh, God.
And they gave me an M1 rifle to field strip, and handing me a rifle to field strip. I was raised in Quaker schools. I was raised as a Quaker. And they're about the only group in the world that I don't have some grievance against, you know, or some. There's no hassle between me and the Quakers. And I took the damn thing apart, and I honestly tried to put it back together. I really tried. Let the record show that I tried to assemble my M1, but I put the trigger in first instead of last, and it fell down into the damn breech. And it's probably still there, and I had to go and tell the sergeant that I could not put my M1 together. Out of a class of 1,000, I was the only one who couldn't instantly put together an M1 rifle. And I was told to leave the university.
The whole university?
What happened was, see, you had to have a, you not only had to take ROTC, you had to get a passing grade. Mm-hmm. And I was like a character in one of those novels by England's Angry Young Man right after the war. Mm-hmm. They'd call me to my feet in ROTC class and they'd say, what is the difference between a rank and a file? And I'd say, a rank, sir, is longer and a file, sir, is shorter. So anyway, I was calling the dean's office, and it was pointed out that in philosophy, for instance, I had an A, and in ROTC, I had less than an F. I actually had more demerits than merits. That if we were asked to appear on the parade ground in uniform, I appeared without my uniform in my civilian clothes, and if it was the other way around, then I appeared the other way around. And if we were required to appear with our jackets, I did not have mine, and vice versa. And they asked me why this was, because if I did not pass ROTC, I had to leave the university. And I said, my reasons are moral. And they said, then get out of this university and don't ever come back. And I did. And I left and I never came back. And I, you know, it would be really wonderful if I could say that I did it out of some lofty, idealistic motive to protest war. But I just couldn't put that damn rifle back together.
Ed aims to please, and so does Louise. So don't hide arms, get sidearms at Ames Guns! 30102 East Rhode Island School of Design Terrace in Ukaipa!
Daddy, where can I get a good deal in a Christian atmosphere?
Here, friends, right here! God Almighty, I'm full of it, but I'm going to let it go. And you've got to let it go. Dear friends, just as sure as you can bet it, one of those two greatest guys up there is going to let go just as you is letting go. Isn't that great, my friends? Isn't that a load off your mind? I know it is off mine. Don't be afraid. Look at it. Close, good friend. Look at that steaming heap of flat buttered goat custards. My.
And I could not understand things like creeping through the bushes and falling on some unsuspecting prey and other military tactics that were regarded as highly important. But I could go into history class and I could go into philosophy class and I could argue coherently in those subjects. But I could not grasp what was being required of me in ROTC. And I think a great deal of my rebellious attitude really stems from a simple inability to understand what's being asked.
You know, we're the last generation, man, maybe you and I, at least specifically, to be in the Army, basically. It is our job to pass on information of a body or useful nature to people who'll never have to go through what we did. Because, like, I certainly hope that no young man in this day and age is going in, for God's sake. I mean, certainly, I would hope you're not doing it.
You don't have to. You
know. No, you don't have to do it, man. And we'll tell you about it. If you feel that there's anything that you may be missing, we're perfectly available at any time to sit around and tell you gory old Army stories, but there's no need to do it yourself.
Secret number one, it's not going to be public, which is you don't have to cut your hair. All reservists. Attention, all reservists. Beep, beep, beep. Driving home from hell. This is Sunday, right?
Oh, this is
You don't have to cut your hair.
Yeah,
no
you guys,
further.
See, let me tell them about Catch 23, man. The Army, if you do something weird, like letting your hair grow, which Bergman and I both did, which got us out, because then they think that you're crazy because you don't want to cut off all your hair and stand around in straight lines. They won't really do anything bad to you, but all you've got to do is convince them that you really don't agree with them. They call that crazy. And
being yourself.
Being weird, right. And it will either get you special privileges for being crazy. Like when I went to summer camp once, they wouldn't let me pull KP. They wouldn't let me do it because
my hair was too long. Right.
And it was dirty.
Gets
you
caught
see.
In the drains.
You get into interesting situations like that and cause a lot of ruckus and feel somehow as if you're doing something for the revolution. Or carry it a little farther and you just get out. They just let you out eventually saying, oh, well, because they don't really want you, man. And they especially wouldn't want you if you started acting weird.
I don't mean to foment revolution or anything like that.
We've got 537 overstrength by 5% men in this unit, and Mr. Bergman, this Army has never lost a war, and it's not going to lose a war to you.
The reservist can't say anymore that he's not involved, not after Kent State or anything like that. It's really hard.
Involved in what, Phil?
I'm an Aries, man. I'm on an Army non-recruiting trip, right?
The fact is, yeah.
Your
right.
Army non-recruiting
If I were straight, I'd be in the Army, and since I'm not straight, I tend to recruit people for the anarchist Army, right. I'm dangerous.
The anarchist Army. Anybody who comes up in for basic training is out.
Right. Anybody who stands in a straight line has to go home.
Listen, I mean, like, if you're inside the Army and you've signed a contract and you're going by their law, then take a look at the law if you must and find out what they can't do to you. It's a bluff. It's a four-card. It's called a four-flush. I don't know if anybody know the word four-flush. It means four to a flush.
Yeah.
It means that fifth card they ain't got.
Yeah.
They can't send you to Vietnam. They can't put you into the bowels of death for you know, growing your hair. They'll offer you out.
Yeah, they will indeed, because they know who hippies are, and they know they don't want hippies, and they know that they... See, really, in the Army, really, the whole idea is having a jolly good time.
The Army is for
people
who
want to be in it. It's having everybody who all feels good, and they all like to get out there in uniforms and do that. And the minute you show them that you don't want to do that, well, they will indeed let you out.
Sure, because otherwise you will become a special thing. A martyr, in spite of yourself, and they can't stand to have that in the unit.
They want
to
have a good time.
They want the guys there who want to be there, so they can sit around and all agree to bitch at least. They like to bitch.
Fascism, wherever it appears, whether it's in Germany, the United States, the Soviet Union, or anywhere, fascism, wherever it appears, is the enemy. Fascism and Germany are not that intimately linked. I mean, fascism is a worldwide phenomenon. It can hit, you know, a bunch of baboons swinging in the trees, you know, in Polynesia. You know, they can all suddenly put on iron helmets and march around. Fascism is very much with us today, boys and girls, and it's still an enemy. I wrote Mannheim Castle with Hsien.
You did?
Yeah. I've been sorry ever since, because when it came time to resolve the novel at the end, Hsien didn't know what to do. I mean, it got me through most of the book. Every time they cast a hexagram, I actually cast four of them and got something and assigned it to them, and they proceeded on the basis of the advice given. Like when Juliana Frank decides to tell Abinson that he's about to be off by a Zischer Heights D's agent, I threw the coins and she got, you know, warning, make known the truth of the court of the king, great danger, and so on. Someone comes up behind him and hits him with a club. That's what she got, and so that she did go warn Abinson. If she got another hexagram, I would not have had her go speak to Abinson.
Yay! OK,
Okay, kids. And we have another letter here from a happy birthday gumdropper, Insector R. It's a little Sally Chink. Ching. And she's 12 years old today. Well, that's wonderful, Sally. You're going to start menstruating soon, huh? Don't you think you ought to...
But then when it came time to close down the novel, Yi Jing had no more to say, so there's no real ending on it. I like to regard it as an open ending. You see, it will segue into a sequel sometime.
When you find somebody with a stomach to write one.
Yeah. Or if Yi Jing ever gets off its ass.
Do you go back from time to time and throw it to see if there is an ending to it, or...?
No, I don't use Yi Jing anymore. I'll tell you, Yi Jing told me more lies than anybody else I've ever known. Yi Jing has a personality. It's very devious and very treacherous. And it feeds you just what you want to hear. And it's really spaced out and burned out more people than that I would care to name. You know, like, like a friend is somebody who just doesn't tell you what you want to hear. A friend tells you what's true. Really, you know. A toady is the old word for somebody who told you what you want to hear. The kings all had their toadies around them, you know, who told them what they wanted to hear. King said, am I the greatest king in the world? Yeah, you're the greatest king in the world, yeah. Well, that's what Yi Jing does. He tells you what you want to hear. And it's not a true friend.
Yesterday, a full million of us in the Hippie Republic of China met in my room to debate this question. We threw Yi Jing out the window. We are now unanimous.
How sweet it is!
One time I really zapped it. I asked it if it was the devil, and it said yes. And then I asked it if it spoke for God, and it said no. It said, I am a complete liar. I mean, that was in other words, I set it up. I set it up. I asked two questions simultaneously. And it said, I speak with forked tongue, is what it said. And then it said, oops, I didn't mean to say that. But it had already...
Then you get a paradox.
Oh, I watched a girl do this to it once.
I mean, that's the paradox.
So,
is it lying when it says it's lying?
Oh, it's just full of... It's a crock, is what it is.
Did you know that Johnny Carson ate Cab Calloway's baby to stay slim?
Where did you hear that?
I read it in the toilet.
Curious people want to know.
Did you know there's a place just 6 feet under the earth where you go when you die?
Where did you pick that up?
I picked it up in the toilet.
Here's what you'll find in the toilet this week.
Princess Di gave birth to a 65-pound show horse.
John Kennedy's come back in a spaceship with a super new diet.
Bert is dating John Hinckley to make Warren jealous.
I'm sleeping with Joan Collins and I don't even know it.
Where did you read that?
In the toilet.
The National Toilet. Put a quarter in the slot and we'll wipe the world for you.
A quarter, now that's 25. There was a 65 and a 6. Hey, Laura, what do you think? Hey, where'd the Egyptian DJ go?
She's gone to the airport. Well,
how do I get out there?
Trust me, player. Try 33.
Okay.
I could be lying. Hell, but that could be a lie.
Slotik, John Slotik said this in his debunking book, you know. It's got some... He covers everything from Scientology to the Mafia. He says that none of them exist. And he says the Yi Jing... You know, Slotik did a parody of my writing, you know. This is much better than anything I've ever done. Have you read Slotik's parody of my writing? Chip Dick K. Kill.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's so much better than anything that I can do. And I walked around, and I was really off the ground, walking on cloud nine after I read the parody. And I wrote Ed Furman, who's the editor of FNSF. Those appeared originally in FNSF. And I said, I have talent. Slotik has genius. And Ed Furman wrote back and said, fine, I'm going to buy a lot of stuff from Slotik now. And he did. He commissioned 8 more of parodies. And they're all marvelous. You know, parodied Asimov. Slotik said I was the hardest person to parody. I have his book in front of me now. In England it's called Steam-Driven Boy and Other Strangers. Slotik says that Yi Jing's a hoax, and Slotik is right. His parody on me is called Solar Shoe Salesman. And then somebody consults these tiles, and it gives him many small greatnesses deny, no same. It does not further to discover gifts only. The wise king avoids fried foods. And I says, oh, Slotik, you finished it off, man. I can never consult the EJ again. And I'll start laughing.
I've solved another one for you.
Danger, I'll never know how you do it. I was sure I had the goods on you this time.
Well, Bradshaw, it's like in the army, you know. The great prince issues commands, founds states, vests families with fiefs. Inferior people should not be employed.
Nick, I can't knock success, but you still put me through too many changes.
As you know, in the late 1960s, experimentation with mind-altering drugs became common among artists who sought new forms of expression. Philip K. Dick was no exception to this. His activity with psychedelics may have contributed to his extrasensory experiences.
The connection between drugs and what I was saying earlier about his skepticism about reality really finds expression in the LSD culture. People like Timothy Leary.
Now this here simple life-size replica of the Taj Mahal, made entirely out of oleomargarine, houses our guru, Dr. Tim. Let's knock on the door and see if he's in. Howdy, Dr. Tim.
I just thought I'd drop out and say hello. Hello.
Come back, Dr. Tim. We want to talk to you.
Oh, welcome to the link of Spirited Guhuri, LSG. Wait a minute. Oh, well, another day, another green, blue, electric, yellow dollar. Got anything to drink? Anything at all?
And why is it that you're drinking, Timmy, me boy?
Because it's bad for my hullabaloosins. I get a chance to see things in real black and white. I despise electric pink.
You know, Dr. Tim is keeper of the sacred tablets.
Yeah, have a tablet. Oh, nice, paisley, horsey. Give the nice horsey some sugar cubes.
The feeling that the experience one had under drugs was revealing that this is all an elaborate play being staged for our benefit to keep us politically quiescent. And drugs allow you to see behind that facade and realize that there is another reality.
But Phil only took LSD twice. And both times, I gave it to him. And the first time he had quite a good experience. The second time he had a very bad experience in which he thought he was a gladiator in ancient Rome. And what happened to Phil was that even though he had never studied Latin, and I studied Latin in high school, so I could understand Latin, but he began speaking Latin when he was that gladiator. He was speaking good Latin, grammatically correct, but easygoing, as if he'd spoken it as a native tongue. And that was spooky.
Ligalorum trentio, Arbis pecularum bandini.
Huh?
Plant a lawyer, grow a money tree.
He has this notion of the afterlife in many of his novels. You could say that the afterlife was a kind of a deep freeze, as if you'd been refrigerated and essentially had been stuck in a shelf in a mortuary, couldn't move, and yet you still had some slow-moving thoughts and communicating with the rest of the world basically by telephone.
I would like to say a word for the Hanging Athenian Gardens, you know, one of our oldest sponsors.
Did they hang here that Athenian yet?
Well, he's hanging, of course, as we all know, out in front of this great restaurant. They feature Armenian food, geek dancing, and those live chickens that you've heard so much about. There's free cheese logs to every woman over 45 who goes in this week only.
Oh, wonderful. I'm so glad I'm in town.
Well, sweetie, don't forget the cheese log throw every Thursday, and you'll get a free sparring partner if you come unaccompanied.
I don't believe in throwing fights. I fight fair.
You do? Ever sat on an antique cheese log? I can't even say it without making a Freudian slip.
I'm in town.
An antique cheese log chair.
I'm not in town for fun. I'm in town because Mr. Foster died, and we're freezing him.
He's going to be Mr. Foster Freeze then,
that's
right?
That's ridiculous.
That's true, but that just happens.
I'm sorry, that's cruel. That's very
cruel. It is, it's true and it's cruel. We're going to freeze him, and then we're going to charge admission to come and see it. We're going to put it in the basement. We figure it's the only way we can afford it.
Well, tell me, are you going to freeze him by normal by normal cryogenic methods?
Yes, we're going to cryogenic methods. We kill him first, and then we freeze him.
Oh, he's not dead?
No, you can't freeze a live person. It's not allowed.
That's murder.
Yes,
it's murder.
So we have to...
He's alive and well? I mean, he's...
Oh, he's fine.
He's in good shape.
You'd like to meet him? Here he is.
Hiya, Pete. Hiya.
Mr. Foster, you don't mind if I... You don't mind if I just open this up to general discussion?
Call me Frosty.
Okay. Hey, Frosty, are you aware of the fact that your wife has designs on your life?
Oh, she's crazy as a coot, you know?
I know, but...
Oh, John,
She put away the money for it and just sprung it on me last week.
Well, it was going to be a surprise.
Well, no. You want me to tell it or you want to tell it?
No, go ahead, John.
Okay. She sprung it on me, the dear little thing, and I... what was I going to say? I wept, for a long time, and they collect the tears, you know.
They do.
Oh, yeah, that's what they freeze. Yeah,
they do, really, orphans' tears. It's good luck, you know.
Right, indeed. Yeah. Most of the tears they get, in fact, are from orphans and refugees.
Sure. They're orphans, particularly.
Refugees.
And refugees. They freeze their parents often first to make orphan tears.
Yeah, God, it's a great...
If it's good enough for Walt Disney, it's good enough for my John.
Do you want me to...
You're going to freeze your John, too? You could invite people to come into that, too.
Foul-minded pervert.
Well, it's because of all the chickens I've been straightening lately.
Well, I'll just sit down. I'm certainly glad you guys let me come.
Watch out for the cheese log.
This story was based on true happenings, and the thread of it is the escape of a young Union soldier from a southern...
In the consultation lounge at the beloved Brethren Moratorium, several customers were communing with their half-lifer relations. Damn this earphone arrangement, Glenn Runciter grumbled as he fitted the plastic disc against the side of his head. In the earphone, words, slow and uncertain, formed. Fragments of the mysterious dream his wife now dwelt in. This is an unnatural place, he thought. Halfway between the world and death.
The only thing I'm confused about is the ending.
Uh-huh.
Because, like I said, I've heard it twice. And both times, it seemed to have come to an end abruptly.
Yes.
As if there'll be another album called, The Return, you know.
How time flies back.
Well, it ends like a minute before it started.
Huh?
The album is conceived as a Mobius strip in time. That is, it ends and begins at the same point in time, owing to the black hole, or the hole in the center of the record.
The hole of the black persuasion.
Right, the hole of the black persuasion, Peter says, through which you can look or travel from one side of the album to the other. Actually, there are a couple of other levels to that, as there are to everything. One, I don't feel that there are endings in life. There are only endings in art. And so I had to come to a compromise between life and art. That is, life goes on, you have to end art.
Philip K. Dick wrote with a hunger to understand what reality was, what it ultimately all meant. And that is a very unfamiliar hunger in this century, where metaphysical questions tend to be treated per se as insane questions.
I think that philosophically I fit in with some of the very late pre-Socratic people around the time of Zeno and Diogenes, the cynics in the Greek sense, those that live like dogs in burial urns, not in the modern sense of the word, that I am inevitably persuaded by every argument that is brought to bear. If somebody was to suggest to me that we go out for, if you were to suggest to me at this moment that we go out for Chinese food, I would immediately agree that that was the best idea I'd ever heard. In fact, I would immediately say, but you've got to let me pay for it. Or if you were to say suddenly, don't you think that Chinese food is overpriced and has very little nourishment in it? And you have to go a long way to get it. I mean, and you have to wait for a long time. When you get home, it's cold. I said, you're right. I can't abide this stuff. And I mean, like, you would have created a vision, you see, for me, of this long drive and this long wait and coming home and these cardboard cartons and spooning this if you were to say, oh, and it's so sweet, they use sugar and everything, and then it's really bad for you. I have visions of very sweet, sticky sauces, and I would think, oh, that sounds terrible.
I'm getting hungry. Hit the dirt! Look out! Was that one of ours? Yeah. Beans. Last of the beans. I'm so tired of Chinese food.
He's quite right. This is a sign of a very weak ego, I guess, you see. But,
Well, there's something more than that going on there. There's also a willingness to believe and a refusal to accept the fact that there can only be one answer to any question.
Well, all right, let's...
I mean, just in the abstract, whether or not it's being imposed on you. If you heard two people discussing, you could probably identify with both sides of the argument.
Well, now, if my view that each person inhabits a unique world is correct, if you say Chinese food is good, in your world it's good, and someone else says it's bad, in his world it's bad. Now, I'm a complete relativist then, in that respect, that for me, the answer to the question, is Chinese food good or bad, is meaningless. It's exactly like the question, is Beethoven's Fifth Symphony a good symphony? To me, this is semantically meaningless. Mm-hmm. If I like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, it's a good symphony. If you do not like it, it is for you not a good symphony. To me, this is so obvious that I can't get into the space of people who will actually argue the merits of a work of art. Now, this is my view, and if your view is that this view is incorrect, you may be right, in which case I would be willing to agree with you.
But remember also one of the main messages that we tried to deliver in the many years that we created comedy in our own particular way was that you're responsible for everything, really. You know, the tomb of the unregistered voter is a classic example of that. You know, we are responsible in many ways for the situations that we create in our society and in our lives. But the other side of that message is kind of like, but don't get too emotionally or spiritually involved in it, because much of it is really, at the bottom line, an illusion. And we always like to reveal the illusion of things that we were all getting emotionally involved in, so people could sell us things, people could scare us into thinking certain ways, voting certain ways, acting certain ways. So you have to maintain your own inner perspective. And that was, I always felt, one of the main messages of the Firesign Theater, which is, I'm responsible for my life, and I'm going to keep it that way.
Absolutely. Very strong.
This is no movie. This is real.
Which reel?
The last reel of this vintage motion picture, High School Madness. Lot number M-25, black and white, 35mm.
Oh, I see.
Now, who started at $5?
All right, let's I guess
go
it was
to 25, 25, 25, 25, 25, 25.
It's all a fake, Mudhead. They lied to me.
Hey, what do you mean, they?
You know, them. Name three. Well, there's the pooper and you and me.
Hey, whose movie is this?
Yeah, it's nobody's now, Mudhead, because I'm getting out.
How are you going to do it, Porge?
I don't know.
How'd you get in here?
Darn, I don't remember.
Well, where were you before?
Before? Yeah.
Right.
What Philip K. Dick did as a science fiction writer was to expand the bounds of the genre to include the most profound and brilliant metaphysical ideas that have ever been examined, I would say, in science fiction, and at the same time to retain what is great and marvelous about the genre itself, which is the excitement, the sense of alien invasion, the sense of talking apparati that interact with human beings, the sense of daily confusing life in some imagined future that resembles our own. He merged the two, and he turned them into novels the like of which we've never seen before.